right.
Good morning, everyone. It is 8:40 on October 3rd. We're in Emma Harbaugh Hall, and this is the Economic Development Committee meeting. I guess we'll call to order. Let the record reflect that Councilor Burgess, Councilor Weiland, and Councilor Moe are present. The second item on the agenda is to consider the minutes of the August 6, 2025 Economic Development Committee meeting. Anyone have comments?
I move approval as presented.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Any opposed? The third item is to establish a new quarterly economic development council meeting time. And I think we can establish a time moving forward, but I'll just be straightforward. My schedule in the spring is unknown to me right now. So perhaps we just establish the next meeting. And Rachel, when would that next meeting be?
That would be January.
It would be. So we probably just wait until December to establish that next meeting. Is that acceptable to everyone?
That's your preference.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. Sorry, guys. I just would hate to set a meeting and just have to go through the process of rescheduling it. So, all right. Let's move on to item four, the overview of the urban renewal and tax increment financing.
Yeah. So we have this is great timing because this is about the time of year that we do our annual TIF certifications for the state and county. And we also have several new or changed urban renewal area and TIF districts anticipated within the coming months. So we thought this would be good timing to just kind of do a look back on recent projects, a general kind of overview, just make sure you're all well educated on the mechanics of how TIF and urban renewal work. This presentation has a ton of information. I know we got started a little late, so I might breeze past some parts, but if we have time at the end, we can always come back and touch on things that we didn't spend a lot of time on. And if you have questions along the way, feel free to stop and ask, or we can do them at the end, whatever you prefer. Okay, so as I mentioned, just going to kind of do an overview, talk about some of our current areas and projects, and then some that we expect to be coming. So first of all, I've spoke to you about this in the past, but urban renewal areas and TIF districts are two separate concepts that work together. So the urban renewal area is the designated area where you conduct the urban renewal project, and then the TIF district is the funding mechanism that you use to support those urban renewal projects. So TIF is how you can capture that tax increment and then spend it on an eligible project. So in general, urban renewal kind of gives you that authority, and then TIF is the funding mechanism. Typically, you can create urban renewal areas with different TIF districts or even multiple TIF districts within one. Typically, what we've done is that our TIF districts match the map of the urban renewal area. So with the use of TIF, there's obviously some advantages and then some important considerations to use it and use it responsibly. So the advantages are that TIF can be a catalyst for redevelopment. When you create that urban renewal area or that TIF district, that can signal that there's public commitment, and that alone can start to help leverage private dollars. And then it can, of course, help those projects that need a little help go by either addressing a financial gap on large or complex projects, or incorporating more public benefits than what the private market would not fund alone. So our TIF policy, which you may recall we updated several months ago, maybe a year ago now, really outlines those public benefits that we like to prioritize when we're applying TIF to a project. And then it leverages future growth to meet the current needs. So our standard application of TIF, or historically, we have rebated a share of new revenue back to the project itself. So that kind of shifts the risk from the city and the taxpayers onto the developer if they don't perform, or if the project doesn't perform as expected. Because TIF again, just important considerations to make sure you're using it responsibly. So keep in mind that when we do collect increment, that means that the tax revenue is temporarily being diverted from the other taxing entities, so the county, the school, as well as our own general fund. So while we may be collecting that TIF to either rebate to a developer or pay ourselves back or something like that, it is temporarily until that project ends. Being diverted from kind of the general coffers. There is a risk of overuse if it can be applied too broadly, and I think that's where TIF often is criticized the most at the state legislative level. And I'll talk through on the upcoming slide just how I think we apply it and have some safeguards in place which help us use it more responsibly. It's obviously a complicated tool, so just making sure we are staying on top of it, strong staff oversight, being transparent in how we use it. And then another consideration, as I mentioned, is that the state legislature has scrutinized it, again, related to mostly overuse or misuse concerns. So that means that TIF reform is often on the table in legislative cycles and something for us to keep an eye out in the future as well. So as I mentioned, these are a few kind of safeguards that I feel we have in place that kind of help set some checks and balances and make sure that we're using TIF intentionally and responsibly. So I would say overall, our policies and practices help us provide a balanced approach. So prioritizing projects that support our strategic plan, avoiding projects that, you know, would happen anyway or don't need our assistance to go, and then just making sure we're protecting that long-term tax base for ourselves and all taxing entities. So our TIF policy is that clear policy framework which outlines our expectations and priorities for the use of TIF. We will use a financial analysis, hiring a third-party firm to help evaluate pro formas when we need to apply a but-for test to make sure that the projects we're supporting truly need TIF support to go. And then we often, like I mentioned, use a rebate model. So the developer pays up front, we sign a development agreement with a minimum assessment agreement, and then once that project's completed, once those requirements are completed, and if it performs as expected, we can start paying those rebates back. So the risk is on them. And then a minimum assessment agreement, as I mentioned, that just guarantees that minimum value and that tax increment that we expect is going to be there so that we can pay ourselves back or rebate the developer back.
And if they fail to reach, if it came in assessed below that, is it on the developer to make up the difference? Is that what the minimum assessment means, or how does that functionally work?
So the minimum assessment agreement would almost always guarantee that it meets that minimum value we established. It's an agreement between the city assessor, the city, and the developer.
Oh, okay. So with the assessor. It's not just between the city and the...
Yep,
got it. Okay, thank you.
All three parties. If the tax revenues are not as high as we expect, we also write into our agreements that our rebates are based on that. So it will be based on actual tax revenue, not their expected economic development grant.
Yeah. Thank you.
I know... when we did the Chauncey, I heard that we did a different system where we kind of just like cut a check or a we just kind of like put, gave them money. Like we used TIF in that way. Can you explain the difference between what we did with the Chauncey and what we're talking about here?
I can. I'm going to cover all those projects, including the Chauncey coming up. So can I do it at that time?
Thank you.
Okay. And then the last is just transparency, oversight, and reporting. So we have to follow all the state processes, hold public hearings when we have new projects, new plans, or amendments. And then we have annual reporting requirements, which come through your city council agendas as well. This is just, as I mentioned, I would say TIF is generally viewed by cities and development groups as an effective economic development tool. But again, be aware that there are legislative and policy criticisms or threats, of course, as we use it going forward. So next I'll talk a little bit about how an urban renewal area and TIF district is kind of established, what that life cycle looks like, and how it actually functions. And this is a lot of information. So to create an urban renewal area or a TIF district, the first step is to establish that urban renewal area. You create that plan. You set the map boundaries. You determine the type of area that it's going to be, which I'll talk about. And you really describe what the goals and objectives and types of projects that you hope to do within this area will be. Then the city council will consider their first resolution, which includes a declaration of necessity. It sets a consultation meeting with all the other taxing entities. It sets a public hearing, and then it directs that urban renewal plan to be sent to Planning and Zoning Commission for review. The consultation meeting is held with the affected taxing entities. That's just a meeting that's held, a time for them to be able to come, share any questions, comments, concerns they have about the plan or the amendment, or they can do that via written comment. I would say recently when we've done like amendments, we haven't gotten any comment or participants in that. And then planning and zoning review is required for new plans only. And they're just, again, assessing whether it's in conformity with the city's comprehensive plan. And then after that is when you hold a public hearing, and an urban renewal plan adoption only requires one reading of a resolution. After you establish the urban renewal plan, you can create the TIF district. So the TIF district is an ordinance, so three readings, so that can start happening concurrently if you want to time up the two at the end. And then amendments follow the exact same process, of course, without the PNC meeting for amendments. So at your October 7th City Council meeting, we'll have an urban renewal plan amendment for the City University urban renewal area to add a couple new projects. So that will be the first council resolution step on this slide. And then to terminate, it essentially follows the exact same steps, but in reverse. You just have to hold that consultation meeting, the resolution, and then the ordinance for the TIF district. TIF districts expire based on statutory limits, so I'll talk about what those sunset rules are on the next slide. Urban renewal areas do not statutorily expire, but we recommend when they're no longer needed that we just terminate them to keep the books clear. Okay, so as I mentioned, when you establish an urban renewal area, you can establish it on several different bases. And what you choose kind of impacts the types of projects that you want to do, and then also what those sunset limits are. So these definitions are all spelled out in state code, but the primary ones are slum and blight, which is really truly reserved for those areas where slum and blighted conditions exist, causing a public health or safety concern, or maybe it's burdening municipal services. And then the economic development areas are a little more flexible. So the commercial and industrial is areas where the city really wants to focus on economic development, creation of jobs, business, new industry. That's, I would say, most common of what we have. LMI residential is for areas where we want to encourage LMI housing development or public improvements, which would support that, or improvements which would support that development of housing. And then non-LMI, my understanding is that's a more difficult basis to use. There are additional restrictions tied to it. I'm not super familiar with this category, but essentially this is also for public improvements that support housing. That is not solely for LMI households. And then you can have mixed areas, so where one or more basis applies. So these are the different sunsets by designation. So there's no sunset for slum and blight. So our original City University area would be an example of that. So our downtown Riverfront Crossings urban renewal area was created under the slum and blight basis, so it does not have a sunset. Economic development areas have a 20-year sunset from the first year that debt is certified. So, oops, I'll show you on an upcoming slide how that timing sometimes works out. Economic development for non-LMI is limited to 10 years, and then the mixed, like a slum and blight, would not have a sunset. You can also establish voluntary sunsets in a plan if you chose to. So this is, you've probably seen this chart before. This is kind of the mechanics of how TIF works. So farthest left on the axis, you'll see incentive start. And that would be essentially the when that base value is set. So usually that's January 1 of the year prior to a project's completion. And then that blue bar, the base tax revenue, that is the tax revenue that's coming in and going to each entity both before that project starts and then throughout the duration of the TIF incentive. The gold triangle is that growth in tax value. So as over the life of the TIF, as the valuations grow and the tax revenue grows, the growth is being diverted to the taxing entity that so like the city in our example, and then it's after that incentive ends, the orange, all of the tax revenue then returns to all of the taxing entities. Does that make sense? Great. So when we talk about TIF increment, we're usually talking about project increment, but a base value is established for both. So I'll just talk about this really briefly, but essentially when the urban renewal area is established, that sets the base value for that urban renewal area for January 1 of the year prior from when it was established. As properties improve or redevelop in that entire urban renewal area, obviously taxable valuations will rise. So then the difference between what it was from the base value and what it is currently, for example, would be that increment value. So you can collect district-wide increment for certain types of projects, but again, you have to obligate or certify the debt in order to do so first. Otherwise, it's just going to go back to the taxing entities if we're not directing the county and the state to divert it back to us. And then the project increment, as I mentioned, this is usually what we're talking about, because when we execute a development agreement with the developer, we lay out what that project looks like, what the incentive looks like, and then we set our base value on that individual project. So if an urban renewal area is set in 1980 and we have a project in 2020, well, we probably didn't have a project in 2020, but we have a project now, that base value would be more recent. It would be just that year prior. And then the tax revenue difference between that base value and the valuation increase caused by the project improvements would be the tax increment that we would consider eligible to either rebate to the developer or ourselves, or however that financing package is working. Does that make sense? So here's an example of that timing I talked about. Until increment taxes are paid, so until the taxpayers are paying their tax bills, we don't have TIF dollars to spend. So that's why we're obligating debt in advance. So in this example, let's say the project is completed in summer 2023. That's the purple star. Then the project would be fully assessed as of January of 2024. Then the city would not certify the debt on that project until December of 2024, and then that sets the base value as January of 2023. So a full year behind when we're certifying the debt. Taxes on the project are not actually, so if the project was finished in the summer of 23, the taxes are not actually collected until September of 25 and March of 26 due to Iowa's two-year assessment taxing cycle. So that means that we can't pay that rebate until we collect the taxes. So our first rebate to that developer would then be in June of 26 after those September and March payments. So it's typically like a two-year delay that a developer sees before they see rebates back on the project.
Do you talk about how legislative changes impact this? I mean, these are occasionally long-term agreements. I'm curious, when the state legislature changes how something is taxed, like multifamily residential, for example, in the last few years, how does that, what are you tethered to, the previous taxation or the taxation at the point at which the TIF period ends?
We would use the whatever the current taxation is. Okay. So when multifamily changed, that impacted what we were collecting in for increment as well.
Yeah, okay.
So the very basic calculation of TIF is, first you need to figure out what that growth is. So you subtract your new value from your base value, and then you apply that against what the TIF levy is. So the TIF levy is different from the, what I call the consolidated tax levy, or the, what do you guys call it? The consolidated tax levy. All the taxing entities' levies combined into one. The TIF levy actually subtracts out those protected levies, so the debt service, a school foundation levy. So the TIF levy is slightly lower, and you multiply the TIF levy by the valuation change, and that's your tax increment. State code authorizes the uses of TIF, so as long as it's located within an urban renewal area and a TIF district, it's authorized under Iowa Code sections in 403, and the project has been identified in an urban renewal plan, and it's consistent with the designation, so either slummer, blight, or economic development, you can use TIF. That's an example, the bullet point three, why we often bring amendments back to you to add new projects into plan. We have to make sure the plan includes all projects that we intend to use TIF for. Limitations on use of TIF would be business relocating from another municipality or public buildings. Not that you can't use TIF on either of these uses, but you just have to jump through a few more hoops to do so. So when we use TIF, we can finance that in many different ways or even use a combination of projects. So a development agreement is what we most commonly use. That's typically structured as a rebate back to the developer after improvements are completed and that increment is collected. Internal loans, that would be an example of what we did for the senior center exterior project. So the city lent itself money from the facility reserve fund, I believe, and then later paid itself back with TIF increment. Urban renewal bonds, state code allows us to bond for projects and then pay those back using either TIF increment, project income, or a combination of both. You can do general obligation or revenue bonds. And then a purchase agreement, 21 South Lynn would be an example of this. Even though we're not applying TIF to the project, our urban renewal authority is actually what gives us the authority to require public improvements in exchange for that land sale.
So I'm going to kind of return to my earlier question. When we use a developer agreement that has the rebate style reimbursement to developer, and in the duration of the TIF there is a change in property tax, is it the bank that holds the risk for the loss of potential property tax collection or the city? I'm sorry if I'm not mangling my words together. Does my question make some sense?
Yeah.
Because if we have a developer agreement and we say, sure, your TIF value can be X, but then there's a radical change at the state legislature level, and there's just not going to be that much increase in tax value because of the rate change, does that...
That's the response I gave to Councilor Burgess earlier, which is we often write into our agreements, or almost always, that it's based on actual tax revenue received. So in the event that there's a change in state law, you know, we're still going to base it on whatever tax revenues are.
So yeah. The answer is that it's the developer and or their bank responsible
however
to fill
they
that
have
gap that is created by the state legislature.
Yeah, and in that circumstance, they're also probably paying less taxes too. So they're on the expense side of things, there's some savings.
Okay.
I also just had a question about, is there some type of like written criteria for what you can and cannot designate in urban renewal or TIF district, because a lot of the categories can be pretty subjective, it seems like. Is there a type of criteria for what constitutes blight or what constitutes like a type of district that you can designate something as?
Yeah, I would say the slum and blight designation is probably the most strict or difficult to meet. Like I mentioned, that truly is reserved for areas that are like slum and blighted. And now you may look at our downtown and it may not appear to be that way, but at the time it was established, that was the designation that made sense. Economic development designations are, I think you have a lot more latitude to designate those. So we consider it a pretty flexible financing tool. Yeah. You would be able to, I think, most projects could apply under
that. So if we designate something as one of the criteria, there isn't probably going to be some state entity or something like that that's going to come in and say, actually, you know, halfway through the process, actually, you didn't meet the criteria. You can't do this anymore.
I think that'd be unlikely.
Okay.
Yeah. we work with our city attorney's office, and then we also have an outside bond counsel who we consult with when we're not sure or just want to make double check.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm by no means an expert, but I have participated in one of these where you go building by building by building and rate all of the facades of the building and rate multiple different components. So it's not a feels like Slum and Blight. There is a professional who would go through and a third party who would actually look. Is that the process the city has gone through in the past?
I don't know. We haven't established Slum and Blight in a long time.
Yeah. I don't know that it always needs to be that detailed. It's probably going to just be dependent on the individual circumstances of the district.
Okay. And then, similarly, these are different incentive alternatives you can offer to the developer. And there are many different ways you can kind of assemble a TIF deal just based on whatever the needs and priorities are of both parties. Okay, so now I'm going to transition into kind of our current projects and districts and just apply some of that slides I just talked about to how it's actually functioning in our community. Don't look at this map too closely because it needs to be updated, but this just gives you a general idea that we have multiple urban renewal areas and TIF districts throughout our community. This is a list of all our active urban renewal areas and then the active TIF projects, so they have a current development agreement that we're paying on within those urban renewal areas. So our oldest is our City University or downtown area, which was established in 1969. And then our most recent would be Forest View. The Forest View, which was established in 2019. So I have a slide for each of our active TIF projects. Just because of time, I'm not gonna probably go over all of them. I'll just highlight a few which have some interesting components to them, but if you have questions about one, we can always come back to it. So this first one is the Hilton Garden Inn project, and this project came at a time when there was a need to diversify the types of users in the downtown. So there were lots of visitors coming in for like university events, but they were often staying on the outskirts of Iowa City because we just didn't have a lot of hotels downtown. So this offered a new use downtown and really drew people in. The project was a 12-story, 140-room Hilton Garden Inn hotel, conference center, and then a rooftop restaurant and venue. For this project, we structured the incentive as 100% increment rebate. So the increment that we were receiving in from the project, we rebated back to them 100% of that amount, and then also 50% of the hotel motel tax revenue generated by the property. So we were rebating 50% of the hotel motel back to them as well. Both of those incentives combined, our agreement limited to either 21 years or $8.8 million. So as you can see, currently we've paid 6 of 21 rebates. That has equated about $4 million. So we'll probably reach that 8.8 before 21 years. And then exchange for that incentive, what did we kind of get out of the project? Well, there were some sustainability features that we required through the project. And then also, of course, it generates new hotel motel tax revenue, which will outlive this TIF agreement.
Does the rebate of hotel motel tax revenue require consultation with any other, like, I'm just thinking of who's impacted by that?
I don't know that answer.
Yeah, no formal consultation. It's certainly something we discussed with Think Iowa City at the time. This is something that I think that they would probably not love to see repeated, but Coraville had done it once before, and they certainly understood the need there. So it does reduce those dollars that go to Think Iowa City each year, but it also has helped Think Iowa City attract even more conferences and events to the area. So not something that we would probably look to repeat in the future, but in consultation with our third-party financial consultant at the time, we realized that the 100% increment wasn't going to be enough to get that done in the period of time that we felt comfortable doing, extending it beyond. I think our most conservative estimate was that 21 years. And if you take that hotel motel tax, that would have pushed it to 25, 30 years. And it was just too long for us to get comfortable with.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, I'll move on. Sabin Townhomes, this is a pretty straightforward example. So just, again, that 100% increment rebate for a maximum of 13 years or just under $1 million. Here, this is a great example of, you see that minimum assessed value we required was $4.75 million, and it's currently being assessed at 21, so outperforming what we expected. Augusta Place is another interesting project, particularly their incentive structure. It tied many different, again, together to help make the project work. So this was townhomes, multifamily project, but it also enabled the city to gain some parking spaces out of it, some improvements to our own facilities with the fire station and city hall entrances, some streetscape avenue improvements, 18 affordable units, so 6 on-site and then 12 that were provided off-site, and then the preservation and rehab of the historic Unitarian Universalist Church. In exchange for that, we offered them 100% increment for a maximum of 9 years, or about $4 million. We also provided a forgivable loan with a reasonable interest rate up front, and then through our land deal, we bought back some of those parking spaces and on-site affordable units. So in total, our incentive equaled about $6.35 million. So Councillor Weiland, you asked about the Chauncey earlier. So this followed a process really similar as we talked about our 21 South Lynn project. So we kind of recapped that during that project, so I won't talk about this a lot, but as you mentioned, this was more of a upfront loan. So how it functioned was we issued, and Jeff will have better history as well, but we issued a short-term 4-year note and then refinanced that into a 25-year revenue bond, which was repaid only from the TIF generated by the project. So in essence, the developer got a $14.2 million construction grant funded through the bond proceeds, and then we repaid that with increment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the big difference here is obviously the city assumed more risk than traditionally we would in a private project support like this. We borrowed the dollars and we're relying on the increment to pay that back, as opposed to the vast majority of other cases in which we don't provide anything up front. The developer builds it and we just give the rebate. So far more risky approach here. But again, at the time when we were going through this, it was clear that the rebate structure was not going to get the project across the finish line.
How do you have a base value of zero?
It was all public property at that point.
Thank you.
So it'd be similar to like a 21 value. South Lynn, correct.
Okay.
So in this case, you had a city-owned property. It used to be the John Wilson's Sporting mm-hmm. Goods store that was there, and then a Greyhound parking lot on the corner there. So
thank you.
That's how that happened.
Is that valuation based on the whole improvement and property?
The current assessed value listed.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this one's a bad example because it's public, but that's how the base value is property plus improvement.
Correct.
Okay. Assessed,
yeah. Well,
thanks.
It would just be the property, the land and building property on it, because the improvements wouldn't have occurred yet.
Existing improvements on the site.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah, like
at
in this case, if it weren't public, the John Good Wilson's storing had some sort of value, correct. Minimal as it was, but sorry.
Correct. Like Park at 201 building on the Ped Mall there, right? There was a small bank building, a Wells Fargo bank building there. So that would have been included in that base value.
Hieronymus Square, again, a pretty simple example. We provided a $600,000 lump sum payment upon completion. Again, that's what worked for their cash flow. And then up to 15 years of TIF rebates at 100% increment, not to exceed 15 years or $8 million. So we've paid 4 of 15, $2.9 million. Again, probably on track to pay that $8 million before 15 years, with a total of about $35 million in new value created thus far. The Tailwind Nest project on the Pedmall is another great example where we were able to obtain a lot of public benefits in exchange for our incentives. So this was an 11-story multifamily residential building project, and then the historic rehab of those Pedmall properties along College Street. So the incentive was 100% TIF rebate for the first 8 years, and then a 75% of the increment for the next seven, or not to exceed 15 years, or $12.25 million. The public benefits in this project included a $1.9 million affordable housing payment. So this developer chose, through our TIF policy, to pay a fee in lieu rather than provide units on or off-site. And that fee in lieu actually helped facilitate the purchase of our 16 duplex units in the South District for our South District Home Ownership Program. So that was a great outcome for the city. Of course, with the rehab of the Pedmall block on College Street, that made that converted a lot of large drinking establishments into more mixed-use commercial uses, so restaurant, retail space, and then it provided a home for one of our kind of anchor nonprofit arts groups, the Riverside Theater. There was controlled rent written into the agreement for the duration of that. Also provided some ADA accessibility improvements, which were sorely needed in these buildings, and then the building was constructed to a LEED Gold certification. Foster Road is a great example, as it's our currently our only LMI housing TIF project. So this was a senior housing development, and that was facilitated through public improvements, which was the construction of Foster Road. So our incentive was a TIF rebate of 55% of the increment back to the developer for 75% of the cost to build the road. And under state law, 45% of the increment has to go into an LMI housing set aside. So we're collecting 45% into a fund for LMI housing, which does not have to be used within this urban renewal district. It can be used anywhere in the community. And then, of course, the public benefits would be construction of that road, which is really nice, has lots of landscaping, side path, bike lanes, and some utility improvements. Riverview West, again, pretty simple structure. We're nearing the end of this. I think next year is our last expected rebate before they hit their maximum. Senior Center, so we've been working on the exterior rehabilitation project. Again, as I mentioned, that was borrowed from the Facility Reserve Fund, which we're paying ourselves back through TIF. At your upcoming City Council meeting, we'll be amending the interior project into the Urban Renewal Plan. Again, just the public benefits of that will be rehab of a historic structure, energy efficiency improvements, and accessibility improvements. So those were kind of more of our development projects that we've done that we currently have active agreements on. But there are other uses of TIF we've done with just district-wide increment in general. So grant programs is one example of that. We've done Towncrest facade grant programs in the past. We've done commercial and industrial energy efficiency matching grant programs. And we've also done building change grant and loan programs in the past. And also, we are going to be launching that here soon. So next week, we'll be launching another round of the building change grant program. And that will focus on facade grant improvements. Facade improvements, reactivation of underutilized indoor space. So say a vacant storefront or unused second floor. Accessibility improvements, and then energy efficiency improvements. So this is an example of where we've collected that district-wide increment. So just the new value within the entire urban renewal area, not specifically against a new project. Another example of how we've used district-wide TIF is for the to support the Strength and Grow Evolve campaign. That was a partnership between the Engler and Film Scene. So this is not active, but I just thought it was another good example of how we've used it. So we provided a $1 million TIF grant to help fund restoration and renovation improvements in both of these facilities, the Engler Theater and then Film Scene's Ped Mall location. And of course, too many public benefits to list for that. So those are kind of our past and current. Did we have any questions about that before I move on to some we're expecting to come up soon? Okay. So the first, as you know, the Greater Iowa City came to one of your meetings and presented on their work in the Sycamore Strategic Investment Districts. So to support that work, as I mentioned, sometimes when a municipality establishes an urban renewal area and TIF district, that can signal public commitment and help leverage those private dollars. So in support of that work, we'll be considering establishing an urban renewal area and TIF district in that area. Of course, if the vision in this area is realized through that strategic investment district, it'll revitalize and reactivate underperforming commercial areas, ideally add housing, improve connectivity and mobility, and then work towards that kind of 15-minute city concept for the surrounding neighborhoods. The iceberg development occurring on ACT property, again, will... We're continuing to work with the developer to assess their needs, but there's likely to be certainly public improvements that will be necessary to serve the development, roadways, intersections, sewers, all those kinds of things. So we're evaluating whether TIF will be a good tool to use towards that. And of course, through this development, we hope to see increase in our housing stock. We'll see some affordable senior housing, and then hopefully some good commercial uses that will serve those residents. The Gateway Project, so that is what the current Forest View Urban Renewal Area would be along Dubuque and I-80. That would activate that key I-80 frontage, and some public infrastructure improvements will be needed there as well to help serve the housing that will be developed. And then the Carson Farms development, this is a case where the developer would be looking to annex into the city. In your strategic plan, we have an impact area that includes an action item to consider residential TIF for all new annexations to meet affordable housing goals. So here we would look to do something pretty similar to that Foster Road project, where we help with the public improvements that would serve that development and hopefully earn housing and low to moderate income housing funds from the project. And then a couple other changes is a few we have to say goodbye to. We had two that expired in January 1 of 2025. So those will need to come before you just to formally terminate the Hines Road and Highway 6. And then two that were established but have not been used, so we're just recommending doing away with them, would be the Industrial Park Road Urban Renewal Area and the Lower Muscatine Road and Highway 6 Urban Renewal Area. We either don't anticipate projects in this area and or they are interfering with the area that we would want to create to support the Sycamore Improvement District, so we'll just get those off the books and start clean. And again, these would all come before you in upcoming meetings.
I don't want to muddy the waters, but I understand that the tax abatement program that the state has is very different than the TIF program we're talking about here. But do they use the same urban renewal zones or the same urban?
Our tax abatement area is authorized under an urban revitalization area.
So it's a separate categorization, different. A separate designation, and a separate map?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's difficult to measure the value, of course, because there's so many factors that go into how a value is assessed on a project. But this just kind of shows, what that base value looked like, and then what the current value is. So you can kind of see how it's grown over time. I would say Foster Road would be a good example because there was not much there. There wasn't a road to begin with, so. Construction of that helped kickstart the housing in that area, so you can kind of get a better idea of how TIF helped the value increase in that area. And then this is kind of drilling down into the from the urban rural areas to the specific TIF projects, and again the new value that was created on each project compared to the TIF costs that we put in for it. Overall, about $72 million in TIF has leveraged about $234 million in new value. And for about every public dollar that we invest in a TIF project, that leverages about $4.5 private dollars. That's all I've got. Lots of information. So let me know if you have any questions or if there's something we breezed past you wanted to go back to.
Is that valuation at the end an increasing number from the current taxable income, like the new taxable income from the increase in the value, or is that just a what it is now valued at versus what it was valued?
This is not the difference, or yeah, this is the difference. So base value is what it was valued before the project improvements occurred.
Okay.
2025 value is its current value, and then the new value created is that difference.
And I would imagine because of the new value, that means more tax revenue for the city.
Yeah. Yep.
Continuously.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. And all taxing entities.
Yeah. Only the city.
I have to admit, I don't fully understand how like senior center TIF project works, where we have a public improvement project, and I don't know how to get that in my brain, but that to me is a sort of permutation of TIF that it's hard to understand because it's a zero value public project, but yet we're increasing the value. Is there a different way to describe that to me that might help me? Maybe I'm the only one who doesn't really get how public improvements can
use. I guess?
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it because that's a district-wide rather than just the project?
It uses district-wide increment. And on a previous slide, I had mentioned that public buildings are not necessarily a by-right use of TIF. So you just have to, when we amend that into the plan, we have to evidence in some way that other methods of financing it would be too burdensome or not financially feasible. So we're able to use the district-wide TIF.
And it theoretically improves the TIF value of the district? Because the piece that I'm having a hard time put together would be the example of the Chauncey where the John Wilson Sporting Goods store had zero value because it was a public entity. And so the senior center is undeniably better. It looks good. I'm really happy we did that. But I don't understand, like, there's zero improvement in the building in that analysis, and that's the piece that I can't.
There's no requirement that it the value has to increase. So in our TIF policy, that's where we have that, you know, carve out for when there's a need to support nonprofit uses and things like that.
Okay.
So a couple things to think about there. The but for test is if we don't invest in the senior center, there's fewer people taking advantage of that facility, which has a lower ripple effect in the downtown, right? The senior center is a big attraction. People are coming downtown every day, not just to participate in things at the senior center, but they might go get lunch, they might go shopping. So if we don't invest properly in that facility, it can be a drag on the, or not maybe realize the full potential. We have limitations on how we can fund those renovations. We can only borrow $1.3 million, or otherwise we have to go to a referendum or we have to have cash to do that. So we can justify in the plan, let's use some district-wide dollars to increase the rehab so that we can continue to have the senior center be an economic generator for everything down there. So that's kind of the justification in the plan standpoint. District-wide TIFs only work in districts where there's natural property valuation growth. So think of all the properties downtown. And because it's a vibrant area, because of property values increasing, you can just kind of go down each and every street, and if everybody's values are increasing 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% per year, that increment is out there for the city to capture if we want. So we're really capturing increment based on natural growth of property values and putting it back into the Englert or to the senior center or those zero value properties.
Thank but to you. Capture the district increment, we still have to pick a point in time and certify the debt. Is that right?
Yes, on the urban renewal area.
Okay.
Also, not to be a hippie about it, but I would say the value is not necessarily monetary, but the fact that seniors live in a better facility, you know? And I don't know, this was also like the, I thought that was a good question or a good point where you said that doesn't have to be a property or a value, a monetary value increase to justify a TIF district. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be. So I'm just thinking hypothetically right now, but, if there was something that potentially was, valued high, but we decided we don't want this in the community anymore, or it doesn't serve the neighborhood or something like that, and the neighborhood wants it out, and the thing that they want instead would have a lower value taxable, but a higher value in like the standard of living. Is that making any sense to you?
Like if you were to support it with TIF, I think it goes back to what Jeff mentioned. It only works in those areas where there's already district-wide increment generated because the value is increasing.
Okay.
So.
I see.
That's why when we create a development agreement on a TIF project, we apply it to what that project is going to be generating.
Okay.
But when there's those nonprofit uses or public uses in the areas where there's a district-wide increment available that's not available in all areas, we can use it.
Okay.
You could think about, sometimes it's helpful to think of an alternative example. If you were to, let's say, look back at like the Town Crest area, sometimes the public has a misconception that you can just put a TIF district anywhere and magically dollars will be available. When we looked at that Town Crest area, that was an area that had stagnant property tax growth or even property tax decline. And so we put a TIF district there. But that TIF district can't do anything until there's some sort of catalyst project because the property values aren't growing naturally year over year. So you really need something to come in, a new building, to be able to generate that increment. So district-wide TIF is not a given. It really takes it takes an area that's already that either has gained or already has some momentum in terms of its property values. So as we look at like the strategic investment district that Greater Iowa City is working on, there's probably a little bit of year-over-year growth in that area, but probably not enough to say revitalize that Sycamore Mall property, right? Should there be some sort of private-public partnerships that's envisioned, you're really going to need a project to come in and say, take a property that's valued at $10 million and move it to $20 million to get that increment. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have any more questions up here. Thank you very much for that presentation. It's such a complicated issue, and I know a little bit more about it, but I certainly am not the expert, so mm-hmm. Glad we have experts at the city.
It's very helpful.
Yeah.
I think we're ready to move on to item number 5, staff updates.
I mentioned briefly during my presentation, but I'll just make another mention that next week we plan to launch a building change grant program. So it's focused again on those facade improvements, interior reactivation of interior underutilized space, accessibility improvements, and energy efficiency improvements that will be offered. Again, we're tying it to urban renewal area and TIF districts where we have increment available. So it'll be offered in the downtown and riverfront crossings, so the City University, as well as Town Crest.
Anything from our city manager? Okay. All right. Item 6, old or new business. Do we know what our next meeting's topic is going to be? I'll repeat Councilor Burgess's ask last time about development.
So in
housing development.
Jeff reminded me, in January is when, so typically in October, you consider those funding requests from the arts and culture organizations to better align with not only our budget process, but some of the other conversations going on, like the Arts Alliance feasibility study and other things. We invited them to the January meeting. So we'll be doing that at the January meeting And then at that time, we'll probably also have results from the Arts Alliance feasibility study, so we could present those possibly.
At this time, are we expecting in January that there would be any changes to either the requests that they're making or the way in which we're granting, or we've just kind of delayed the same thing we would have been doing now to then?
More of the latter. Okay. I've advised them, you know, there's lots of questions, of course, with all these other processes going on, but I advise them that we'll continue on the same path.
And, yep. And can you talk a little bit about the lost opportunity that we'll all be voting on in November? If that is successful, it is a one more year until there's money. Is that?
No, that money would that tax would be implemented on July 1, so the day it's one of the fiscal year that you'd be working on. It wouldn't be necessarily collected day one, right? There's a delay there, but yes, you could consider increasing the contributions to those arts and culture organizations
next fiscal year.
With this budget that we're working on. Yeah. So that's one of those variables that Rachel's mentioning that, you know, come January, you're going to know whether we have a lost or not. And that'll be probably a critical decision for the three of you to make recommendations to the full council on whether under that community partnership umbrella, we want to increase the grants that we've historically offered to these organizations with those lost dollars if it passes.
Mm-hmm. No other old or new business. Look for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.